Okay, well, we got that solved. The wonderful thing about the world of electronics is that when things go dead, they really go dead. You have to have four different ways of solving a problem. And as you know, I am not at all proficient, and I really need to correct that. I'm not as proficient as I ought to be in the fine art of working with electronics. Well, I was having a rough time, I must confess, especially over the weekends. It came over me in quite a rush, and I was quite depressed about it. And that is the state of affairs of the country. We've been talking about it forever, but it seems of late that we have a we have one thing piling up on the other, and it all leads to an almost total collapse, if you will, of the systems of government. They've become so overwhelmingly corrupt, so completely separated from the people. There's so much theft, there's so much hate. This president has ushered in a kind of administration we have never really seen. Completely chaotic, with people who are totally unsuited for the positions that they have, creating even more havoc. So over the weekend, it kind of overwhelmed me. And I thought I would do something about it. We should talk about this because everybody's feeling it, but it's not being solved. So I said, well, that means I have to talk to people who are on the ground and who have been battling this kind of malaise for years. I too have been underground battling for years, but I really felt it over the weekend. And I said, you know what I should do is to reorient myself and find a way to summon up something, some kind of cosmic energy to get through this period that we're all experiencing. And the one person who came to mind, actually two, but we'll start with Elena Herrada of Detroit. Now, I must tell you, I've never met her in person, and yet the interaction we have had has been so enlightening to me, so energizing, because as an activist, she has gone up against the system for so many years, even threatened with jail, and all kinds of things to derail her life, personal life. And yet she continues. So, on a day like this, when I woke up with the remnants of a depression that I don't deserve and that still impedes, it still shadows my view of things. It still affects me deeply. I thought I'd ask, Elena, what are you doing today?
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It sounds like we're going to have a pity party, but I know that's not the way you operate. It's not the way I operate either. But I cannot ignore the fact that this condition that we are in as a nation is very overwhelming because you do get a sense that there is nothing we can do. Nobody's listening. Nobody's doing what it is that needs to be done to give people a break and to operate the apparatus of government responsibly. Well, tell me what you're doing. So maybe that would help.
I'm doing a few things, and so are many other people, and I wanted you to just I'm going to tell you a few different things that are going on, and they may not sound related, but try to stay with me here. Everybody is doing something, even if it doesn't appear that way, and even if everything seems to be very disconnected. There's people that are operating in the ways that they know how, and one thing that is really crazy to me, but I want to address your despair. It is really a strange thing that Trump is the president. It's very strange that he can do all of these things. But even stranger than that, to me, the most bizarre thing is that there are hundreds of people in Congress and in the Senate and in the legislatures that are standing by watching this. You can always find a crazy person, but what's unusual is that everybody lets them run the country. Mm-hmm. What's unusual is that everybody's just standing by, and it's as if everyone is talking about a bad child, but no one is saying, well, why is no one stopping him? No, where is the movement to actually remove him? Internationally, he's a complete threat internationally, but it's not him. It's everybody that's just standing by who are in positions to be able to move him. And where's the CIA when you need him, for Christ's sake? But anyway, that's another story. All kinds of dirty tricks have been done to leaders throughout the world at the hands of the U.S. So it's not like there's just no idea how to address this madman in power. But coming back to the ground, let's come back to the local. Now, I wanted to tell our listeners that many, many years, there's a group of us in Detroit that have been documenting the oral history of Mexicans in Detroit. Because my family, among hundreds of others, was caught up in the repatriation where Mexicans were recruited to work at Ford in the 20s. That's what most of us were doing in Detroit, like everybody else that came here, came to work at Ford. And then when the Depression came, were summarily rounded up and deported, even though about 60% of the people across the country who were kicked out were U.S. born. And we don't have a tradition of oral history per se. Mexicans are very inward in that way, so we really didn't have something like people talking about it and telling their families about it or describing things that had happened. So there was a lot of holes in our history that we didn't really understand what happened, and we were never encouraged to ask any questions of our elders. Like, why don't we speak Spanish? And why don't we have any connection to other Mexicans? And why don't we have any idea of what happened during that time? And why are we so far behind other immigrant groups who came at the same time? Economically and politically, why are we so far behind Germans and Poles and Italians and others who came at the same time? Well, the reason that we're so far behind is not, as it turns out, because we're stupid. It's not, as it turns out, because we're lazy, but because we were actually removed and sent back. So we were set back a generation behind those other groups that came around the same time. So they advanced where we were starting over with learning English and beginning to try to save enough money to buy a house or whatever the things do that are the American dream that had been sort of deferred to repatriados or the repatriates who were kicked out. And then I come from a small number of those who returned, because they had nothing in Mexico. So we did a documentary. It's called Exiles from the Promised Land, Los Repatriados. And we did this in 2001 in celebration of the 300th anniversary of Detroit. And we really didn't know what we were doing. It was really hard to get people to talk. And we did a very, very makeshift home documentary of the Detroit Mexicans, the families who had been deported. And it was the first time that we had had a public discussion about the repatriation. People were so embarrassed and so ashamed of being deported, even though they had nothing to do with it. They had no hand in it. And I said, you know, I don't really know what to tell people of why we're doing this. People were angry that I was opening this wound. My own father was really angry with me, and his dying words were, you know, I never liked the work you did on the repatriation. His dying words to me. So it was just really a hard thing. But then I thought it's important to know, one, so it doesn't happen again, and two, so we can say to our community, look who we are. Look what we've come up against. And this is the reason that we act this way. Just to begin to grapple with this and understand. And it wasn't like anybody else's. It's not like a Trail of Tears. It's not like a Japanese internment. It's not like Native American dispossession and genocide. It's not like slavery. It's not any of those things. And I'm not really raising this as, to use my friend Betito Martinez's term, oppression Olympics. This is something that was uniquely Mexican-American in our history, and we didn't have it documented, so we are going on the record. So now we're looking at people who were born here and adaptive students, of course, who came and grew up here, and we're saying to them, look, we're going to get through this. This is a very, very difficult time, but at that time there was no social media. There was very little literacy, so people lost entire branches of their family forever, never to be seen again. And we're doing this in order to be able to say, we've been down this road before, but we're better now, and we're better situated. Nobody is going to be lost forever like they were. And the difference between then and now is that our families had nobody, and we are here. We are the children and grandchildren of repatriados, and we are here, and we're fighting this, and we're not going to stand idly by. We will be bruised, we will be embattled, but we're better for this. That's one aspect of this terrible time, this reign of fascism that we're in, then I can say, look, this is a point of resistance, and we are better off than we were before. We're seeing ourselves almost in reruns in terms of civil rights, in terms of the huge backtracking of the gains that have been made over the last 50 or 60 years. But we are also better for many of the things that have happened, and we are not going to stand idly by while people are deported, removed, dispossessed, sent away. So I just wanted to raise that as one aspect of what I would say is a candle in the darkness.
Well, you have lit many candles in the darkness, and not just in the strictest sense for the Mexican community, although that is a very important part of your work. But you have gone to bat for all kinds of people who are depressed by political systems that have an entirely different agenda in mind. Where are you now? What is the struggle now for you?
Well, on the very local level, and I'm one of those people who believes in voting, even when we see what happens to our votes, even when we repeal the emergency manager law and end up with it anyway. We've had every black city in the state of Michigan has its voting rights stripped from us. And I say us because those of us who are in we're in cities where we have no voting rights. So we have Snyder, who poisoned 100,000 people in Flint, and many people have died of Legionnaires, who lied before a congressional committee, still at large, walking around being the governor. We have Duggan, who was a write-in white mayor, who absolutely did not win that election, but that election was purchased by Dan Gilbert of Quicken Loans, and he's about to do the same thing again. We've had all kinds of reasons not to vote, and most of the people in Detroit do not vote, but voting, I still consider it active resistance. And we have an exciting election here. We have the son of the late Coleman Young II, running for mayor against Mike Duggan, who is the billionaire's dream boy. And it's a really exciting time for the election. There's absolutely no television coverage of Coleman Young Jr. because he's not crazy and he doesn't do anything scandalous. So he's a very, very bright, young, energetic joyful soul who is 35 years old and running for mayor of Detroit, and I'm a proud supporter of Comey Young II. I loved his father, and I love him, and they're very, very different people. But they both have very, very clear understanding of the situation in Detroit, and both have an absolute heart for the people. And in many ways, the older people are really happy that he's running. All of the people who are involved in the privatizing and contracts and everything that there is to be had are supporting Duggan. So there is deeply, deeply a line in the sand here in ways that there hasn't been with the neoliberal Democratic agenda that makes it very difficult to discern a Republican from a Democrat. It's really different here. You can really tell the difference here. That's exciting.
Well, you've been, I should say, a prison cell or jail cell is nothing new to you.
Right. That's true.
How do you undertake these struggles knowing of the real possibility that you could be, you know, dislocated, removed, and
frustrated? Yeah, it's been very hard. But at this point, I'm 60 years old, and I have four daughters, and I have five grandchildren. And it would be as if you're just hoeing your row, and you do it in a certain way that you know is the best way to go. At a certain point, there is no turning back. And I try to also provide examples to the younger people who, most of all the activists, are on 501c3 nonprofit funding and are on a very, very short leash. And they have to be somehow encouraged to be able to walk away from grants, to walk away from funding, and stand up in order to be able to say, I'll find another way. I'll go to work at CVS. I'll go to work in a factory. I'll go to work someplace and just organize on my own time, because the movement cannot be funded by philanthropy. This is one of the things that I'm trying to really get across to younger people, because those of us of the older generation had some kind of context for, you know, working and organizing, and you did things in your off time. But now there's a complete appropriation of all struggle. So the nonprofits are, you know, this is what I try to tell young people. If you're going to a meeting about change and you're getting paid, then you're actually working for the banks. So it's a very, very hard thing for young people to get used to, because, you know, that's basically a generation has grown up on nonprofit funding. And they go from one to the other, and it's a small circuit, and they talk to each other, and they won't hire people that are too radical, and they won't hire any black people in Black Detroit. It's the white nonprofits are running everything from behind the scenes. So it's really, really a time of trying to strip away the false veneer of fake organizing and fake participatory action research and fake just fake everything and just rip it away. And that's the position that I'm trying to hold and not get people to discourage. Just people that are literally afraid to talk to me. So it's, you know, it's like getting past that, I think, is a big part of where we're trying to go.
As we look at this administration, in what ways would you say it has distorted our own vision, or we have allowed it to distort our own vision and our own purpose?
Where did it go?
Contacted by one of the collection agency hired by the IRS, we are the experts on the Fresh Start program and can save you more than 80% if you qualify. Press 1 now to speak with a representative.
Okay. We're having a little technical issue. You know, I should say that Elena is in a car someplace on the side of the road trying to conduct a rational discussion with somebody who has no idea how we manage these things. But we'll Chatelon and see if we can reconnect with her. I hope what you're getting is the essence of a person who truly is committed and therefore expects some suffering, expects that things will not necessarily go too well, but continues because she understands that her energy, her investment in a project or a person at a particular time, especially when it's needed, literally can change the course of things. As I said, I've never met her in person. I've met her on the air. We've talked a lot. And you're back, Elena?
Yes, I'm back.
Okay.
I'm back. I wanted to answer your question about how we see ourselves or how we understand ourselves. I really do think that this administration has done a tremendous service by clarifying things. And there is no, there's such clarity in what side you're on. There has to be really, look at what's happened with the NFL. Every single area of life is impacted by what we're seeing here. Every single thing that we're seeing is impacted. And people are talking about it everywhere you go. And I do think that there's been a tremendous amount of people having to face things that they haven't talked about before, things that haven't been discussed. I know in Detroit, we're having the World Council of Mayors here in the next couple of weeks. And the whole narrative is around what a tremendous comeback Detroit has made since the bankruptcy. And that is such a, it's true that the Detroit has done very well since the bankruptcy. If you are a banker, if you benefited from the bankruptcy, then you were one of the looters. The same looters that are now in Puerto Rico. The very same people. Jones Day, Judge Rhodes, the bankruptcy judge, they're actually the very same people in law firms that are in Puerto Rico right now that have been here. And it would be like somebody standing up and saying that they've been successful rapists. And then just expecting no pushback and no, that nobody's going to come forward and say, yes, you were very successful and we're not having it. So I want to just raise that up as one of the things that's going on is a lot of counter demonstrations around the World Council of Mayors coming to Detroit this month. Thank you to Moratorium Now and We the People, the Warriors Against the Water Shutoff. All of those groups are coming together to push back. Our educational system has been completely dismantled. And it's a very similar thing to what's happening in Puerto Rico, where you dismantle the people's economy and then charge them to restore it and then give out the contracts for that to your friends. It's disaster capitalism gone local. It's locally done here. So we've been watching this in Detroit now for the last 9 years under emergency managers and a law that we repealed and then just simply had put back on us in every black city, but not the white cities. And now in today's news, I see that the rich communities along Lake Michigan that have fabulous summer homes are now being told that they can't do Airbnb and their local control is being removed from them. So finally, rich people are actually getting a taste of what it's like to lose local control because the state is going to step in because they want to be able to take those resources from them. And they're not going to allow individuals to just get rich off of their summer homes that they're renting out. So Airbnb is a way of people being able to funnel their own money into their own resources. But the state isn't having that because the state needs that wealth because it's a wealth extraction machine. So it's very interesting. And I think that even though there is great division among black and white and Latino, there's terrible divisions. There's divisions among rich and poor. There's also some things that are slowly coming together, if that's making any sense to you.
It's making sense. And I'm glad I was able to get a little pep talk from you today. because I feel a lot better. You know, the thing is that is so impressive is the clarity that you have. And it's a word I use a lot on the program. People, a person once asked me, you know, if I could have anything in the world, what would I want? And I said, clarity.
Right.
Just, yeah. If I have clarity, I'm okay. So mm-hmm. I want to thank you for giving me some clarity today about, you know, the work that we do. Because sometimes we do get overwhelmed by the negative aspects of it.
You have to remember too that you don't always see the flower of the seed that you planted, but it's coming. Somebody is reaping a benefit from it, even when you don't see it. And I can think of a million examples, and I know by your exposing the truth from different places, like little old Podunk Detroit right here, I think that people can take heart when they hear it and find the parallels in their own lives and their own communities and begin to, this is how we restore ourselves.
Well, I thank
you. What you're doing is so important.
I thank you for helping to restore me this morning. I needed it. And thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
You're a very special person. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. Take care. Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, we're going to still stay in Detroit. And we'll be talking now with an activist. He's been in the community helping to fight off the predators for many years. Again, another person I have never met personally, but we've met in the course of doing our work by phone. And his appearances here on the program. And I so value his analysis and his work, the dedication to improving communities, all communities that are under attack. He's editor-in-chief of Pan-African Newswire and a co-founder of Moratorium Now, Coalition to Stop Foreclosures, Evictions, and Utility Shutoffs in Detroit and Surrounding Areas. And his whole life, his life's work has been to coalesce political power. And his name is Abayomi Ezekwe. Abayomi, so great to have you here today.
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful and very complimentary introduction.
And it also happens to be true. I just finished talking with Elena, and this whole the conversation that we've been having is, you know, I'm feeling this groundswell forming around this Trump administration's ability to just crash and burn, you know, and it was depressing me over the weekend because it's so enormous, it's so pervasive, it's everywhere, and it is finally an administration that, in for the first time that I could remember in my entire life, we have had such a rotten administration, completely dedicated to making money for themselves. They're punitive, they're nasty, vindictive, and they're not competent at all. And we are heading down this road to perdition at 100 miles an hour, and he seems to be having a ball. So what are we doing? Let me ask you, how do you continue doing the work that you do?
Well, what I get inspiration from are the people that I work with here in the city, enormous amount of information that's now available now. You feel as if this is just not happening to you, not just happening to your community, but it's happening on such a broad level, as you mentioned before. Even if we take the healthcare issue, for example, the attacks last week on the Affordable Care Act, which in and of itself, I have a lot of criticisms of, but what is their alternative other than to leave millions of people without any form of health insurance? This is cruel. It's inhuman. It's the type of attitude that's fueled, I think, by racism that is promoted, and it uses racism as a mobilizing force against people. But the contradiction is that a lot of the people who are going to be hurt are people that voted for Trump and who continue to support him. So this is the irony of the whole situation as it stands right now. You have people being persuaded to act against their own interests on behalf of someone who is unabashedly committed to the enrichment of the 1%. When we hear about the tax cuts, we know what that means. That means more tax cuts for the most wealthiest institutions and families and individuals in this country. It does not mean tax cuts for working people and poor people. So these are some of the attacks that we're being subjected to, as you say, on a daily basis. It's unrelenting, absolutely unrelenting.
Well, a group of mayors will be assembling in your town. And for what purpose, and what is your interest in this gathering?
Well, the World Conference of Mayors, which is an organization that brings together not only city administrations, but also organizations. For example, the National Bar Association, which is the black lawyers group in the United States, is an affiliate. They're supposed to have representatives from various cities across the United States and the world. I understand there's even two mayors coming from the West African state of Liberia. But they're coming here on a false premise. They're coming here being invited by the corporate-imposed mayor, Mike Dugan, saying that Detroit is a template, a symbol, a model for urban revitalization. And we are organizing a counter-summit, not necessarily to attack the people who are coming here, because they've been misled, like so many other people around the country, to believe that Detroit has turned the corner and is heading back to sustainability and prosperity. But we're going to have a series of events where people here in the city and from other cities of the state can actually speak out about the actual conditions that are going on in Detroit, and also to put forward our own vision of what a revitalized city would actually look like. For example, there would not be property tax foreclosures. There would not be water shutoffs. There would not be inadequate public schools. You would have a situation where tax revenue would go to the people who pay the taxes, not to the most wealthiest, as we have here in the city of Detroit in the state of Michigan. So this is what we're doing next week, starting on October the 23rd. We're going to have, kicking it off, Reverend Edward Pinckney, who is a former political prisoner here in Michigan. And he's going to be speaking from Benton Harbor. And we're also going to do some outreach to the delegates that will be coming to Detroit. We're also offering a alternative tour of the city, not necessarily through the financial district and the riverfront, but to go into the neighborhoods and to see the impact of the corporations and the banks and what they've had on the city of Detroit. And then on Thursday will be the high point, which will be October 26th. We're having a Real Detroiters Speak Out event at St. Matthew St. Joseph's Church on Woodward Avenue. And this will give people an opportunity to put forward their own ideals of what a truly and generally revitalized city would look like. So this is a political and an ideological challenge to the status quo in Detroit. And we could not allow this conference to be held under this false premise without some response.
Well, As I said, I just finished talking with Elena, and she is involved, she said, in this effort to get elected, the son of Coleman Young, who was a very popular mayor of Detroit, and now he is running. Do you see his candidacy as having the potential of revitalizing a political reconstruction in Detroit?
Yeah, he's speaking directly to the people in the neighborhoods, and he's running a more or less a street campaign because Dugan has all the money. He's been given literally millions of dollars by very wealthy interests, most of which are outside the city of Detroit. He's backed by the corporate media. They advertise him on the news every night, every time there's a groundbreaking of a building, every time there's a group of people being hired on a job in Detroit, anytime you have something that he can exploit, they'll have him on television to make it appear as if without him, all these things would not be happening. But yet, when there's a discussion about poverty, where Detroit is the still the most impoverished major city in the United States, he will refuse to show up. If you ask him, well, what happened to the hundreds of millions of dollars of federal funds that have come into the city to help homeowners, the hardest hit fund for homeowners, he has no response, or he avoids wanting to meet with people or responding to people. So I think Coleman Young II has to run a street campaign. He is getting more and more volunteers, but it's going to be tough because we have a situation in the United States today where money determines, in many cases, the political outcomes. We saw it in the presidential election. Even though Hillary Clinton spent probably $1 billion, she still got the popular vote, although Trump won the Electoral College. And the corporate media promoted him. He really didn't have to raise that much money last year. And they're still promoting him in a twisted sense by talking about him all day, all night, nonstop, his tweets, his executive orders, his statements, his golf outings. So this is what we're subjected to on a daily basis. But we have to take a stand. We have to fight back. And I think in the long term, we will prevail.
So where does your fuel come from for fighting back?
Well, I try to get exercise, rest, mental stimulation. So those are three avenues right there. And also just the sheer level of injustice is a motivating factor as well. When you look at even now, the National Football League has become such a terrain of racial struggle in this country that even brought about the intervention of the president as well as the vice president, making all types of disparaging comments, Mike Pence walking out of an NFL game last weekend before last. So when you see all this going on, the fact that Colin Kaepernick, who is a very talented professional football player, has in essence been whitelisted out of his own profession. And I understand now he's filing some legal action charging collusion by the owners of the various teams that make up the NFL. This, to me, is very, very motivating from the standpoint that the injustice is just so blatant and so outrageous that we're compelled to do something about it.
Well, I wanted to know if you, we started our correspondence with the just before the formal declaration of bankruptcy in Detroit. Mm-hmm. Looking looking back on that experience and be seeing now the parallels with Puerto Rico, I talked about that already, but we have to get into the parallels of Puerto Rico, where Puerto Rico will simply cease to be the Puerto Rico that most Puerto Ricans know. But as you look back, what political strategies did you gain? Did the people gain from that experience?
Oh, a lot of lessons were learned. For example, the whole issue of democracy, what is it for? The denial of democracy, or bourgeois democratic rights, as I like to call it, is designed to enhance the profitability of the corporations and the banks. These are major lessons that people in Detroit have learned over the last 4 to 5 years. And also the courts, unfortunately, in most cases where it really matters, we cannot rely on the courts, because the courts at this point tend to side with the 1%. So you have a situation where you could have a very stark injustice, and you take it into the courts thinking you're going to get some type of redress, and the courts uphold the injustice, oftentimes on technicalities. So these are lessons as well. And also that we cannot rely, in many cases, on the elected officials, that they too have been co-opted. They have been bought off. Many of them do not work for the residents of a particular municipality or even for the country as a whole, but they work for particular interest groups. We see that clearly here in Detroit. They are literally looting. Even after emergency management, after bankruptcy, they are still looting the resources, particularly the tax resources of the people of Detroit and the state of Michigan. There was an article 2 weeks ago in the local weekly Metro Times newspaper, who's taken a very, very harsh editorial position against the current Dugan administration. And they pointed out that Dan Gilbert, the owner of Quicken Loans and the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball team, has arranged a scheme where he will get $1 billion in state and local funds to construct a new office and shopping complex on the old J.L. Hudson's department store, which used to be one of the largest department stores in the United States. It went out of business in the late 70s and was, went out of business in 1982. And it sat there for about 20 years. And then it was raised by the city. So they're going to build a new complex there on Woodward Avenue. The plans are underway for that. But the bulk of those funds are not coming from Gilbert. The bulk of the funds are coming through convoluted methods of tax capture. And we had a similar situation with the recent opening of the Little Caesars Arena, which is part of what they call District Detroit. The city is on the hook for $324 million if the program, if that project does not succeed, if it's not profitable. We could be on the hook for as much as $863 million. So they're backing up their speculation with our tax resources. And this was a crime as well. So these are the lessons that we've learned over the last several years, just some of the lessons we've learned.
How have people applied, in your view? Because you're in the field, you're in the street. Are people applying these lessons that they have learned?
Some are and some are not. Many people still remain in denial. They don't want to believe that the situation is the way it is. And of course, people in some cases are susceptible to what I call bribery. These people like Dugan and others who have a lot of resources, they're good at singling people out and co-opting them or even neutralizing them. And we have a lot of that going on in the city. For example, certain groups, they solicit their participation or endorsement. Other groups, they won't touch them with a 10-foot pole. Now, there's one community organization in Detroit on the east side, the Charlevoix Village Association. They put forward a list of 10 demands to the city. This was like probably 6-8 months ago, because they feel as if their neighborhood is being gentrified and that the residents who have been there for decades are being ignored and in many cases being forced out. And the city took months to make any type of response to them. And the response they were given was provocative, to say the least. So these are the type of things that are going on in the city, and I'm sure going on in other cities as well, with working in poor people, even middle-class people, being forced out or being forced to pay more to remain, while wealthy interests, not only are they not paying taxes, they're actually being subsidized with the tax dollars to engage in these type of prestige projects that are so prevalent in cities like Detroit.
Has Detroit passed the tipping point, in your view?
I don't think so. I really do not, because the city has not taken the question of poverty seriously. Now, the Brookings Institution did a study 2 years ago, and they're not a radical left-wing organization at all. And their findings reveal that the city is still per capita the poorest in the United States of any other major city. Now, the FBI, who I don't support and really do not trust, came out with a report several months ago that Detroit is the most violent city in the United States. Now, both of these studies have not been adequately responded to by the city administration. For example, the question of poverty, there was a town hall meeting which Coleman Young II, State Senator Coleman Young II, who's running for mayor, wanted to debate the incumbent, Mike Dugan. Dugan did not show up to this discussion. So he does not want to discuss the real conditions under which the majority of the people in the city of Detroit live under. Now, in terms of the FBI report about the rise in violent crimes, Dugan refused to comment on the report. The police chief, Craig, I guess he was allowed to respond, and he said he disagreed with their conclusion because they were based on false numbers and that the numbers that the police department have are more accurate, which would, you know, refute the FBI's conclusion. Well, MLive, which is a online news service here in Michigan, does a lot of good investigative work, went to the Detroit Police Department website and looked at the figures there and compared them to other cities across the United States. Instead, you come up with the same conclusion, whether you look at the figures on the police department's website or you rely on the figures by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So this is a type of avoidance that we're subjected to. Interesting enough as well, the FBI's report indicated that violent crime was up over 15% across the United States in 2016. So what does that tell us? That, you know, we have more aggravated assaults, more sexual assaults, more homicides. The mass shootings get a lot of publicity. For example, what happened in Las Vegas and last year in Orlando, Florida. But it shows that the country is really on edge in a lot of ways. And I think it's, in many ways, it's coming from the top down, that we have a leadership that's erratic, that is more interested in stirring up controversy and hatred and division rather than solving the problems that really exist inside the United States. So I think it's a very dangerous time period for the United States. So, no, I would not say it's Detroit or the United States as a whole has reached a point where we could possibly be going in the other direction on a positive level.
So what does this say to you as a person in the middle of all of this trying to make some sense in behalf of communities under siege? What are you prepared for in the work that you do?
Well, we have to be prepared for a lot of obstacles, but also successes. I mean, the fact that we have been able to exist for a number of years and been able to maintain an office. We still have people who come out to our meetings, to our events, people who are still willing to struggle. I mean, we have had some victories over the last, particularly over the last 2 years as it relates to property tax foreclosures. We've been able to at least slow down the process tremendously. In 2015, there was approximately 35 to 40,000 people facing tax foreclosure. This year, that number is down to less than 2,000. And a lot of it is because of pressure that's been exerted by grassroots organizations. So that's very, very positive. But at the same time, there's so much more to be done. People need jobs. They need incomes. They need economic opportunities. They still need quality housing. People need quality education. The state of Michigan has virtually wrecked the educational, public educational system in Detroit and in many other cities. So there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. But despite all of that, I'm still very optimistic because I know what the rulers of this country are doing. It's not out of strength, even though they have the power to do what they're doing. But it's really manifested in their desperation. The fact that they have to have a Donald Trump, or even a Hillary Clinton for that matter, if she had have won last year. This is not the leadership that we need in the United States at this point. We need to end these senseless wars. Afghanistan, it's been going on now for over 16 years. Iraq has been going on at least since 2003, actually going back to 1991. So all of this needs to come to an end. The military bases, the blanket bombings, carpet bombings that are being carried out against Yemen, the massive killings, which are not even being reported, in Iraq and Syria that are being carried out by the United States, even in Raqqa, in Syria, civilian areas were bombed by the United States, even when it was not necessary to do so.
We have a lot of work ahead of us. I'm glad to have talked with you today. Because I feel, you know, there is a creeping sense of, I mean, this is going to come to a head and it would be a really bad turnout for the people who really have nothing to do with this. And those of us in a position to influence the way we are thinking and doing things, we too are under attack. So this was a very good and a very eye-opening and I dare say very encouraging discussion. And I thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, Abayomi. Coming up next, Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And I encourage you to share this program today because we're all activists and we're all facing this kind of pressure and we all need a little bit of encouragement. Bye-bye.